Good evening, everybody. My name is Christopher Tarnowski, and I'm with Flylogic Engineering, and glad to see a big turnout for the last track of the day. So this track is going to basically consist of a very deep analysis of an older microcontroller from Infineon. At Black Hat, we decided we'd do the Infineon 44 series used in some smart cards from Xilinx. Have anybody ever heard of Xilinx Data Security? No? Link encryptors, things like this, trust your data with them on your laptop, so forth. Who uses smart cards here? Anybody? Awesome. You guys probably use much newer ones. The problem with the newer ones is the principles you're going to hear today all apply to tomorrow as well. But you have newer challenges as everything starts to shrink. The average smart card today is about 180 nanometers. What we'll play on this evening is going to be about 1,000 nanometers. The average smart card today is getting meshed now with active meshing to keep this type of stuff from getting direct access to the bus lines or the memory outputs, things like this. I'd like to go through a quick overview of what I talked about at Black Hat, and then get as much time as possible probing with you guys. And we'll actually sit on the bus with this chip, we'll eavesdrop it, and I'll explain some points, because some of you will probably be thinking, well, we run encrypted busing, encrypted address fetching, scrambling, who knows what. And honestly, that's good, but these principles apply to everything, because there's always another way to skin a cat. Who uses the 6805 or the 8051? Excellent. Now, do you guys know assembler? Most excellent. You guys count clock cycles? Good, because we're going to count some clock cycles. So this chip is again, it's pretty old, but if you can grasp what we're going to talk about, you can do it to anything if you get, but you've got some challenges, obviously, ahead of you. So, momentary fault, what is it? Basically, it's opening up the chip to get to the substrate and temporarily changing the behavior of this state machine that's running, because that's really what a microcontroller is. It's a complex state machine with specific behaviors and dynamic behaviors. So the change is always going to be precisely calculated. It's guaranteed as soon as you do your homework and do your calculations of where to apply it. Most of the time, the fault lasts no more than a few clock cycles. I had wanted to do a demonstration with a Stack Overflow. However, it took too much time, given the probe setup the way it is. So I'm going to show you basically a destruction of a loop that reads bytes out of the E square of the chip. Normally, we'll get 16 out, and with one glitch with a needle, I'll make it spill 256. And I could keep repeating this loop as well. This particular glitch is going to last one clock cycle period inside the core of the 44 series Infineon part. Sometimes, though, I may hold the fault forever. Maybe I want to, freeze the instruction latches and make the code make the chip latch a 2-byte fetched instruction of some kind with like an instruction and an operand. Something like this is very, very favorable to a hacker, and most of the smart cards today still don't have any defenses against this. I take that back. They have defenses, the meshing, the size, and such. But once someone overcomes these, there's no defenses, for allowing me to read out all of memory, mess with the MMU, change memory mapping if it's over 64K, things like this. So there's always going to be challenges, but what you're going to see today is it applies to it. It's just you may need to think a little bit outside the box to get it to work. Just for the slide up, I should have asked you guys, you want to sit on the bus. Does anybody do reverse engineering here? Okay. Substrate reverse engineering with microscopes, needles, and things? Anybody? Okay. This chip, any chip, is no different than a PCB if you lay out PCBs. Anybody do PCB board design, things like this? Okay, excellent. So the only difference is instead of doing a scan on a PCB, on like a scanner to look at the tracks if you're trying to trace out wires or using an ohmmeter, you need to use a microscope. And to touch these wires, they're much weaker than we are on the outside world. We need to use like a very low capacitance buffer or an op amp, for example, something very light, so the wire doesn't sink down and the slew rates don't get destroyed for the transition between a 0 to a 1 and 1 to a 0. The driver needs to be capable, for our purposes of this talk, an op amp won't work because an op amp is only going to take the signal out, amplify it, and bring it to you. That's just listening. We're not going to just listen. We're going to listen, and then we're going to momentarily induce a fault that we've chosen at what point in time to do it. So we know their clock counts. We know where they are at what precise point in time, and we're going to physically change the value on the bus at that moment. The driver needs to be low capacitance, needs to be capable of driving a 1 or a 0, because this way it gives you the flexibility. If it's a 1, you can make it a 0. If it's a 0, you can make it a 1. If it's 180 nanometer technology or smaller, maybe the voltage, you can't make a 1, let's say. You don't have a driver that supports like 1.65 volts, maybe. Maybe you find then an instruction that you want to instead drive to a 0, because it's very easy to force a line to ground through a driver that's running at 2.5 volts or 3.3 volts or 5 volts even, just as long as you don't drive 3.3 or whatever into it. So the chips are getting smaller, getting lower voltage. There's new challenges, but all of these techniques today will apply to anything tomorrow. So why do we do it? Why do we do it? We do it because maybe we want to overwrite the stack pointer, make this loop, as you'll see soon, repeat as many times as we'd like. I've only prepared it to do it once. It's not really useful to do it more than once because the high side of the data pointer is not getting incremented, so we're stuck in a page of 256 anyway. But maybe this is not a microcontroller, because this is not just smart cards. This is also any type of silicon device that you've got, any digital circuit we can apply these techniques to. Maybe it's a cryptographic ASIC of some kind, and you want to falsify a Mac or an HMAC or a cryptogram of some type. This technique can apply again. It just takes a little bit of effort on your part, on the attacker's part. So to put the fault into the chip, we're going to need to physically touch the substrate. So we've got to open it up with some assets. None of this is being discussed today. You can see the video on Wired. Has anybody seen the video on Wired? Okay, I was very tired, but good. Good. Did you understand most of what you saw? Good, even better, good. So you take that and you, again, apply it to today. There's some new challenges, but it's the principle of what I did in that video, that with a little bit of thought, you can do it. Infineon 6688s have a mesh, 220 nanometer technology, 5 metal layers with the mesh. So use a fib, bridge the in to the out, and then use my wet chemical techniques and blow a hole right through it and get right down to the core of the 66P. Okay. So this is a Thomson 19 series processor. Don't remember which one, but something I took a long time ago, and it's very interesting. So you can see the yellow track is the data bus of D0. The blue line is a trigger, some trigger that I had. The green line is the clock. And again, just going back to this chip versus that chip, this chip happened to run on an internal clock. So this green clock you see actually had to get plucked out of the CPU with a needle. So this was many needles, I think 5 needles on the substrate. But for this point and purpose, we care about D0 and the fact that we're in sync with their internal clock. The purple line is reset. So this is literally like 5 or 6 instructions on the D0 bus line. D0 is the LSB of the instruction fetch or the data bus. It's also the bit that flips the most. And you make a 0110, change 24 to 25, anything. In Motorola, like 21, 20, 21, 22, 23, they're all the complements of each other. In 8051, it's a little harder because it's like 20 or 30, jump if not bit, jump if bit. But you move the needle to bit 4 instead then. I prefer to use D0, though, as much as possible. So you can see here, we're just listening. My blue line is some type of a trigger point, it's probably the trigger point that tells the driver to fire. Fire meaning I've already prepared my higher low level glitch. So I've set that side of the 126 that I'm using to cock the chamber. And that trigger is basically the trigger. So here in the next picture, we changed it. We physically induced a zero when it should have been a one. And so you can see, I changed the entire instruction processing afterwards. Now we're only sitting on D0, so we can clearly see that what came afterwards is some other fetches, and some of them, the one was on high a lot of periods and then down low and on high again. The instruction cycle period here is pretty quick. It's like 10 or 12 megahertz for a smart card. Anyway, so this is the theory. This is the whole theory. Before we do a glitch, you don't just randomly throw, you don't put a needle on the bus and just start jamming it down the ground or jamming it high and stuff. You're just going to go nowhere. So the first thing to do is for us to take what I call the running code. So it means that we basically put a needle on D0, we come out of reset, so we turn on VCC, we have the reset line low, we just start the clock, and then we release reset, and we just basically, we take, say, 32 kilobits of samples on D0. Then we save it in the software, and then we move the needle to D1, and then we do D1. And we can put down two or three needles if we want and do them in batches of two or four, etc. It's quicker for me to use one needle and walk the bus, so to speak, to do this running log than it is to manipulate two each time. How many needles do you think it takes to dump one of these smart cards? You guys think it takes a SEM to dump one of these smart cards? Anybody know what a SEM is? Scanning electron beam microscope? Does anybody use a SEM? Or do SEM prepping? It's a pain in the butt. And I don't use a SEM. I don't even use a FIB for half the chips out there today. And you'll hear all these rumors that a FIB and a SEM at university level is needed. It's never been needed, and it's only now needed since, say, 2002-ish, when they started to get below 350 nanometers. Anything above 350 is typically only three metals. It's really easy to get to metal three or two. If it's below 350, typically it's going to be a four metal layer. It could even go up to five, and plus a mesh maybe. The microchip, the Microsoft licensing device, 8-pin SoIC, and every one of your wired or wireless controllers used on an Xbox 360, it's got a little Infineon chip inside. Infineon's so paranoid that you're going to get to their logic underneath that they laid a triple mesh. So they got two active meshes with a ground plane in the middle. Infineon kept that practice and took it to the SLE 88. Does anybody use the 88 series SLE? No? 32-bit RISC from Infineon? 66, single mesh, very easy. So we're going to study running code on this chip. None of these principles about meshing and things apply. The chip's very opened up. We're going to look at the code, see where it went, and we're going to pick an instruction that we want to change. And the instruction is going to give us something that we want it to do and not what it should have done, such as keeping a loop that fetches a byte and transmits the byte to the outside world. Keep it going. So if a DJNZ is one, what happens? It loops one more time, but when that goes to zero, it's decrement jump if not zero. Your jump stops and you fall through to the next piece of code. So what if when it goes to execute that instruction, I change, in this instance here, that one being read out to go into the ALU to decrement it, because that's exactly what happens in this 8051. You see the program counter low on the bus, you see the opcode fetch. You then see on the VJNZ of R or whatever, you'll see the value come out of the register into the ALU. You'll see it get decremented and stored back again. So if it comes out with a 1 and I hold it to 0, it goes in as a 0. It underflows, becomes FF. FF's 255. We get 255 more bytes back from the loop. So be very careful when you do like move X at A at the data pointer, increment data pointer, that type of thing in a loop. We don't always play with the data bus, although we will today. The data bus could be encrypted. It could be in the clear. It honestly doesn't matter. You could kind of tell what's going on with behaviors of CPUs typically, unless there's some wacky, zany, crazy, no one knows the instructions of that CPU. 8051s 0 to 255 possibility for what the instruction really was that got fetched, if you are encrypting it. 6805, same boat. AVRs, things like this are a little wider of an instruction. Changes the rules, but again, these principles apply in theory. Address bus, though, can change, you know, location 0, I can make you go to location 1 instead. You don't know, but whatever came out is going to be, you know, is going to be used by whatever is being done at that behavior, at that state of time. Address bus faults, typically, I'm only going to play with them on a cryptographic memory type devices. Atmel crypto memory, Dallas OneWire type parts, things like this. Things where I don't really have control. I can read out public areas of memory, but I can't read out private areas where you hide your key material or secrets, seeds, things like this. So it knows if it gets to 80 that it throws a mux, and you can't read out that data, so it sends you zeros or FFs. Depends who did it, you know. Everybody's got their own way to do things. So what if we tell it to read 0, but I force bit 7 high on the address bus? What's that become? I just ordered something into the bus. It becomes 80. So let's say 80 is protected, but I gave you address 0 to read from. So I told the chip's logic with the firewall area of the chip is saying, oh, it's 0, it's okay, let it go. But I'm ORing in bit 7 later on behind the address bus drivers. Well, behind logic where it can backfeed. And it works beautifully. So 0 becomes 80, 1 becomes 81, and so forth. Does anybody have any questions? If you do, stand up, please, and just ask. I want this to be very interactive, and I want you guys to come up on stage and put a needle down, too. Anybody want to play with the needle? Okay, cool. Excellent. Anybody have questions to that right now? Am I going too fast? Because I'm trying to cram this in. You, sir. Absolutely. Five needles is easy too. You start to go above 5 needles, it starts to get really hard. The more needles people that I talk to that don't really appear, you know, that maybe are telling little lies and stuff, they typically tend to exaggerate the needle count on how many it would take to extract the code from a processor or something. But if I can make behavior repeat, if I can make a fault repeat, I can maybe do it in 2 needles. But with this technique, I can do it in 1 needle. Let's say you're doing software, and you know, you may say, oh, well, we do software randomizations, or we do hardware randomization. You know, so you're randomizing things in hardware, like the cores randomizing things with dummy bus cycles and stuff. That's fine. Then I'll put down another needle, and I'll eavesdrop the internal latches of where the instruction's coming in. And now the only time that I would need to clock in data is when those latches open and close. But I would miss some of the bytes too. I would miss operands because the latches will not open and close on there. So you generally, honestly, 1 to 2 needles, I'm done. 2 needles, I'll do it quick. 1 needle, I'll build a script. Let me rephrase this. With 2 needles, I can not care about what's in the code, and I can simply freeze an instruction in the code and basically walk the bus and read out memory in most cases. Or I can let something run, freeze it, and then let something else run, this type of thing. Maybe skip over signature check. You could do anything by freezing instruction latches. But it's also very beneficial for a 64K memory map to do a readout. Like on the older 6805s from Thompson, Motorola, this stuff. The newer stuff has MMUs. Memory management unit. So you have more than 64K of physical memory. So you've got to kind of let the processor work for you. And then when you get that page mapped into memory, then do your attack. Things like this. But 2 needles, 1 needle, you pretty much you're good. Does that answer your question, sir? Okay. Yes, sir. Somebody had a question over here. Yes. We'll go there in about 5 minutes. So you mean structure-wise, how do I know what I'm looking at? Yeah, we'll go there in a few minutes. And I think that's kind of something you kind of learn with experience if you've got the time to play. But you can pretty much tell who laid it out as you open up devices, because maybe they won't mark Infineon on a smart card, although they do typically, or ST, they do. The cell library is going to look just like it does on the off-the-shelf stuff of that feature size, of that geometry. you know, and like, for example, today, Intel's down at 45 nanometers. That's pretty small. But I don't need to probe the actual logic. I need to get to the wires. And that's where we're going to go there in 1 minute. Anybody else have any questions before we continue? Yes. What's the chip?
It's a
Super
H chip.
Hitachi or Renesas. I'd have to see it, read the spec. The spec's going to tell you a lot. I mean, they
don't really tell you if you're not supposed to use it for long hours.
Well, I'll give you a good example. This badge has a 9SO8 on the back of it. Anybody use the 9SO8? Nobody? Anybody use the Freescale Motorola? I call it Motorola still. The Motorola Freescale 908s? Like the JB12, things like this. The 908 was more secure than the 9SO8. The 9SO8 got shrunk. It's a TSMC process. It's a 250 nanometer four metal layer. And the irony here is they tried to make you believe that it's super, super secure now. So they tell you if the last address in memory has to be a complemented, like a 1-0 combination on two bits, on like bit 0 and 1. And they tell you, so when you do a bulk, the only way to clear this is through a bulk erase, blah, blah, blah. That's great, but what if I tell it to bulk erase? Oh, and wait, 1 second. Then they warn you, once you bulk erase it, you need to make sure that you set those bits back to 1-0 because they become FF, all ones. You need to set those bits back to 1-0 before the next reset. So what's that tell you? That tells you that in logic, they just execute a bulk erase, and then in these actual bits that would normally load that address and store that, am I locked or not, they clear those for you. So what if I cut the VPP line? Does anybody know what happens if I cut the VPP line and then tell it to bulk erase? It doesn't do anything except clear those two bits, and then I read your chip out. So, I mean, just food for thought. There's a lot of ways to get into these backdoor monitors and such that run. And a lot of these chips are being fabbed by TSMC, like Freescale. I'm trying to think here, who else? I see it a lot. You see it a lot, though. There's a databiz.wiz or something out of like Irvine. They're making a smart card. It's got like 10K of statogram on it, 32-bit ALU, 16-bit opcode fetch. It's a TSMC, same exact memory model. Once I learn the memory model on the off-the-shelf Freescale parts, I can just buy their smart cards at $10 a piece, and I can whack them. You know, I know exactly where databus outputs are, clocks, address structure. Be careful. Databus faults are all we're going to focus on today, and it's the most probable choice. It's very easy to spot the databus, and this is what your question was about before. It's got to come out of the memory, and it may come out of the memory encrypted, but that doesn't mean that you can't understand. At least you can understand when it loops, because if it's encrypted, if a 20 FE, it's the wrong chip, but that's a 6805 branch to yourself. So let's say it's an 80FE, a short jump to yourself in 8051, either of those two. Let's say they're encrypted and they're coming out as, 1055. Who knows? You're going to see on the bus, you're going to see 1055, 1055. You're going to see this come out constantly. So you know that, you don't know really what it is, but you can tell it's a branch to itself and it's sitting there forever in an endless loop. So you just figured out two instructions from that address point of what they decoded to. But you may not even need to know that. You can see encrypted code running in loops. Let's say I know a 66 is non-ISO reset. Does anybody know what non-ISO reset is in an Infineon 66, 44? It's when you hold the IO line low and you release it out of reset and then for about 400 clock cycles, and then you release it back to a pulled-up state, to a 1. It then identifies you. It's chip lot and things like this. This is what we're going to exploit today. If it's encrypted code, I can see the loop where I can see encrypted code that says basically, do a fetch from wherever the data pointer points, transmit the byte, and then you can see decrement whichever register it is, go back up and do it again if it's not done. You can see it, you just don't understand it, but you can make heads and tails out of it quickly if you're focused enough. So be careful if you run encrypted data buses, and these techniques are still going to apply. Anyway, cryptographic, we can make key spills, as I explained before. Execution steps, same thing. Determine when to induce it. We may want to repeat the fault. We can if we want to. Just you need to precisely time things. I want to get to more of log traces that I've done and take some with you guys at this time and show you some code snippets from this Cypress chip, which is like defunct, over 10 years old, and show you what I see on the bus and show you where we're going to do our attack, and then we'll demo. You can basically watch exactly what I'll do, but in my lab it's much quicker because this is the wrong equipment, but this is something you guys could build yourself too. This was built purely for like a show and tell. Otherwise the probe station is over 300 pounds. Okay. So, I mean, technology, it's improving and it's getting good. It gets great. And the whole theory here is, how much money is it going to take? How long is it going to take the person to do it, to be successful? And then will they get the reward back? And that's really what you need to focus on. And I think a lot of these companies are on the right track to do it, but there's still a lot of room for improvement, and there always will be. Every smart card to date that's ever been made by these manufacturers, except possibly the 88 series of Infineon, has been broken by pirates, if it's been used in an area where they can sell counterfeit things. And it's not just like conditional access for television. It could be satellite radio, for example. XM satellite radio, they're using a Thomson 19. I don't know why they're using it. It's not secure. Scientific Atlanta, they're hiding a Thomson 16 and 19 in their set-top box. Why? It's obscurity, and obscurity is not security. It's a layer. If it's made by human, it could be taken apart by human. So I'm going to get out of this, and I'm going to try to kind of work with you here a little more dynamically and interactively. So this is, does anybody like ROM bits and things like this? You heard people talking about doping ROMs to read them back out. That's probably the most useful technique of today. And the reason for that is because most likely, if you're not encrypting the address, you're scrambling it. They're scrambling it, and it needs to be decoded. So that means not only do you have to study the put the bits all back together the way they went, and you may make a mistake optically, you need to understand the address decoding logic as well. It's a lot of work and effort, and the method we're about to get into is a lot easier. But if you did want to study the ROM, you could play around like this. This is the actual instruction dispatcher table of this 44 that we're going to play with. This is a 500 magnification view of the ROM stripped down to its poly diffusion area. And so now you can kind of see I didn't finish this. And you guys are welcome to all these pictures and such. I just didn't want to post them on a public link. But if anybody would like them, I'll have business cards at the end or my email's on the presentation. Email me and just ask for it, and I'll give you a link off my server. And you can download the whole archive. It's going to be about 800 megabytes. Yes? This is a photograph through an optical microscope, Zeiss Axiotron 2 with confocal scanning. It's a 500, it's 50x objective with a 10x mag, so it's basically a 500x magnification of the area. Again, this is a 1,000 nanometer process. It's pretty big. I mean, anything under 130, I need UV. I need to use ultraviolet with camera, and I have to make mosaics to study the logic. But again, the wires, I can see them. I just can't see the actual gate structures, which you can make out based off of the way things come into metal one, what the circuit might be doing, and then if you can put a needle on it, you can just deduce the behavior immediately. So you can see here, I drew little lines. It's a 36 across. This is common 44 Infineon 44 series instruction dispatch table. It's a 256 by 9, 256 elements with 9 bits across. If you want to look at it as a table, it's in bit form though. It's 36 across and 64 down. So you can see that right from here to here, there's 32 plus 4 more, and that gives you 36. And then each one of these rows, there's 64 rows. So this has been chemically wet etched with buffered hydrofluoric acid before this image could be seen like this. I then took a dark field reflected light image of the area. It's 4 or 5 images. It's four or six tiles stitched together as one. And basically, you can see everywhere. I mean, I didn't finish, but if you guys wanted to play with this in Photoshop like I started, anywhere you see right here, for example, I would put a dot there, put a dot there. Wherever the blue and the red lines cross, if there's, if you see the glass that's connected, the poly or the right here, put a dot there. And then it's either, then you can walk every, so this would be a bit, this would be a bit, this would be a bit, and so forth. Every first one for, let's say, address zero. It may not be decoded that way, though, but that's just a hypothetical example. And then you may have it backwards. The dot may be a one or it may be a zero. It all depends on the remainder of the logic, how they laid it. But we're not going to go any deeper, but you can have the pictures. All right. So we're going to go into this chip. It's got a mathematical coprocessor in it. Again, it's doing RSA internally. Does anybody know what RSA is? The cryptographical algorithm? Okay. I don't think it's any larger than a 512-bit RSA type mathematical setup. However, you can see it. You can tell this is a crypto block. It's isolated by itself. It's actually been like an extension to this chip. They took their normal 44C80 and they added this math block to it. And it's basically a ton of RAM and some shift registers and you know, demodular multiply, whatever you need to do, square. But this is really where we care about. We don't care about this area. So just we'll forget about this area and we'll go right into here. Does anybody know what this area is right here? This is the non-volatile double EEPROM. It's only 8K, and it's a pretty large element. Your static RAM is going to be your smallest size element, but largest area consumed for the amount of cells that they're giving you. So you've got some static RAM here. You've got ROM here, I believe 32K, and you've got 8K of EEPROM. So you know that there's busing structures that are going to tie into here. Then we can see there's some type of a ROM here and some type of a ROM here. Here's the ground, here's the I.O. line, here's VCC, reset, and clock. ISO 7816, most of you guys know what this is? Do I have to explain it? Half duplex, smart card, after reset, sends out answer to reset, tells you what about itself. Okay. So this is a 5x mosaic, 50x mag. It's too small for us to try to look. We can't see anything. We're looking, we see like there's some busing structures. We see the static RAM is right here. It's connecting. We can count the lines. I mean, this is 1,000 nanometers, so a 50x mag is good for a general blow up of what are our goals, what are our challenges, what do we see to kind of plan your attack. We see some lines coming out. We see some lines here coming up. They kind of meet in the middle area. So something's telling me that this would be a pretty good area to kind of sit on and sit in. We know that the 8051 has a multiplex data bus, so we know that the low address of things are going to be present on it, and static RAM is connected to it, as well as the E square and the ROM. There's no MMU because we know it's within 64K of a virtual memory map. So we take this. We already located where we want to be. We want to look in here. We're very curious. So we image it at a higher mag in that area only. This is two rows of 10 each. So this is not just two pictures here. Ironically, the older chips do not look as pretty as the newer ones do. The newer ones have a lot of different colors in them and stuff. So we look at this and we start to see some bits, some these lines that we saw at the 50x mag, at the 500x mag, now we can see a little bit better where their vias are, how they're plugged down, things like this. So we see 1, 2, 3. Hey, look at that. This one's plugged into that same track, and it goes up towards that static RAM. So we're on the right sheet of music, or we're heading in the direction. Then we got another one here. There's another plug, another one, and it keeps going. So this looks like it could be a good candidate to be the data bus of this chip. It is the day of us, the chip, to cut to the chase. So it's pretty easy to find the data of us a lot of times because you know the RAM is connected to it. That's the moral of the story here. It's not the case in all smart cards and such because they try to isolate things nowadays and throw them through muxes, what area of memory are you in, things like this. But you can always go to the edge of the ROM because you know the chip powers up out of its ROM. So you know it's running right there. And the data bus drivers are always pretty straightforward of what they'll look like. You can see here that there's... Actually, you can't see here because I didn't go enough. But you can see down here, if I zoom in more, you can see this is repetitive logic here. Does anybody have any idea? Anybody do logic that has an idea what these are? What do you think they are? Yeah, they're latches. They're the instruction latches. So there's two ways we could suck the code out of this chip. We could induce a bunch of faults we could study the behavior of the running code, which we'll do, and we could then like look at what was happening on this bus, and we can change the instructions as they're happening to force an overflow of the stack possibly. It takes a long time. It takes me maybe a whole morning to do this, to get this Trojan to work. But when I'm done, I just put a single needle down and press a key, and the key, and it executes like clockwork on any of these. And so that's the easy way. That's the hard way to do it, but the payoff is, the reward is tenfold when I'm done. Yes? No, that's a very good question, actually, and I didn't even talk about that in the intro. The point is to do maybe you want to know the RSA key of this chip. Maybe you know how RSA works. You know that you send in whatever, and it processes it with its secret key, and it returns a result. Maybe you want to make a clone of this card, or, well, I don't know why you'd want to do it, but if you're in like satellite TV pirate, you'd want to make a physical change to this to turn on all the services, for example. Or maybe it's a crypto memory and you can't write unless you know the secret, so you have to sign something to get it in. Things like this is why you'd want to get the code out or make a change to it. Oh, you do. Well, you need to do it. So basically, you need to look and see how... Okay, I'm sorry. He's asking, like, how do you make a Stack Overflow work? And it's no different than if you guys write in a if you guys are Windows hackers or something, or, you know, these guys writing these Windows exploits. It's the same theory. You basically write further into memory than you should be allowed to, because we changed the instruction to make it continue in its loop, receiving data and storing it indirectly. So an indirect pointer basically is writing in memory. The stack has to reside in a memory somewhere. It would be nice if it was in its own private area, such as a PIC microcontroller has its stack privatized, but in most cases it doesn't. It's right there as well. We find some locations in memory that are of use. We already have seen a lot by looking at the running code. So we can pick addresses to jump to off the stack. So we're basically just going to reload the stack, adjust any type of loop pointers to make it stop, and hope it hits a return soon to execute the sequences that we've pushed into place, kind of. But these pushes should never have happened. They're happening because we'd executed this physical glitch with a needle. Or, you know...
So you would have to already have
if it's a 6805, beautiful, beautiful. Yes. So he's asking about executing RAM code from RAM. That's even better on the 6805. You can instead load your worm into the RAM and then tell the stack now jump to 100 or wherever your code went, and you know where it's getting stored because you've already analyzed the running code of the chip. The goal, the goal is to get the secrets out, get the key material out, or maybe do a permanent modification to the chip to where now you have free write access to it. Most of these chips do not let you write to the E square anything useful. The only way you're going to do it is to kind of invasively or through voltage glitching. You might have heard of on loopers, things like this. Make it skip an instruction, or in our case, modify an instruction to abuse something and do it. Once it's done, though, you have complete control. Okay, so we're going to look at some logs, actual logs taken today. I'll show you a couple logs, actually. There's too many chips to get into. I wanted to get into the 66 on a Gem Plus. Does anybody here work for Gem Plus? Really? You're going to love me. No. So I have like some 6805 Gem Plus cards here, and from the IBM Smart Card SecureWay. Does anybody use this to secure their laptops or files and stuff? No? Okay. How about GemSafe? Does anybody use GemSafe? Has anybody ever seen this little orange card? They're on eBay. Actually, both of these cards are on eBay for like pennies. And that's where these came from. You just buy 100, 200 of them for pennies. And then you can do all your R&D to hack them that you want to. Leapfrog, has anybody ever heard of Leapfrog? They went out of business. This is the same processor as this without the crypto. Okay. GSM, SIM card, anybody? clone your GSM SIM card? That's exactly why we're here. Except today they use a lot of Atmel AVRs and such, and Infineon 66Ps, things that are hard to get to. But they did use easier chips 8 years ago. I mean, I've had the pre-comp 128, whatever, dash one algorithm out for 6-7 years now, because they put it in an 8051, they put it in the 6805, they put it in chips that were never really that secure, that got, you know, CC certified, common criteria certified, FIPS, whatever the FIPS is, 180 or 140 certified, and so forth. So here we go. I'm looking for the better log. I have a commented log more than that one. Okay, so basically, what you're about to see is basically the dumped code that came out, some snippets, so we can kind of line up, so just so you can understand that what we're seeing on the needle with the needles is actually, it's the same as what you'd write in assembler. It's just, you kind of have to, you don't see clock one, clock two, clock three. You have to kind of parse it apart. And I do this manually by hand typically, although I do have tools to automate it. So bear with me 1 second. Yeah, this is actually, I want to show it to you, but I'm just looking. I have one, I'm trying to find it, that's heavily documented on a lot of the instructions to kind of show you. Otherwise, it's kind of really the lowest level that you can get inside of here, unless you really want to start tearing the poly apart and, you know, and see the gates and everything. And that's something, I mean, I do it. Karsten Noll does it. There's a lot of people, Bunny Wang, we all do it. But this is much easier than starting to tear apart logic and decode it and put things back together. Okay, this is fine. This will work perfect. Okay, so this is a log I made a while back. So the chip powers up. The manual barely even tells you what clock cycle it really starts running at. This particular chip takes a while to fire up. They clear FF to down to F8 and RAM to a zero. And so you can see it here. You see on clock cycle zero, clock cycle one. So this is basically what period of time the processor was on when I took the sample. But I didn't just take the sample once. I had to repeat this 8 times. So I put one needle down and walked across the bus 8 times. Just let the code run. If you've got randomizers, I'll see it, because all of a sudden the code that looks normal will become garbage, basically. And so I'll just look in front of what happened before that went to garbage, and I'll just whack that and stop it. That'll be glitch one. You know, so no, I'm very serious. I see a lot of chips with like an E square has a seed value that then seeds software randomization, and it's great. You guys should be randomizing things and trying to take time between the ATR first byte and the second byte coming out and things like this. You've got to get the first byte out fast, and then they send it out fast, and then they try and randomly change the delay between the second byte and that first byte. And I mean, I guess it's good, but there's other, you know, there's other things that they should be worried about. But everything, you can never not do enough. That's really, don't forget that. So we sit here, boom, finally at clock 3F hex, this chip fires up. Can everybody see this? I don't know, let me see if I can zoom in. Is that better? Okay, I have no idea what it does. It's like a function icon on my laptop. Okay, so, but it works, you know. Okay, so at clock 3F, we've got a zero on the bus. Guess what? It's the program counter, the low side of the program counter. Remember, I told you the 8051 is a multiplex data bus. It means you're going to see, it makes it take more time, too, because that's a wasted clock cycle right there. So you wonder why that move of an immediate value into a register on this 8051 took, I believe, 10 clock cycles. It's because three of them were address sets of the low side. So with PCL gets set to a zero, boom, all of a sudden a 75 is sitting on the bus on the next clock cycle sample. And then again, there's a 75 on the next clock cycle sample. Then we see a PCL of 1 come onto the bus. And then we see the operand, then we see a 2, then we see the operand, and here's the end. This would be the end. So this is the complete, this is exactly what's on the bus of an Infineon 44 series 8051 during a move an immediate value of 80 into register D8, which I have no idea what it does, because I don't have the data sheet. Does anybody have any questions now? Okay. Are you guys bored? Okay, good. I'll go all night. but we got to put some needles down too, so don't forget. Okay, so then boom, here we go with a program counter low of 3, and it just continues and continues. So I'm flowing the code on every clock cycle. I see what's going on. I mean, now we can go, let me shrink this, and let's put these two next to each other. And I run Linux, by the way, as well. There were some comments online that, oh, he's Windows. Yeah, most of my tools are Windows. It's so easy. But my server's Linux, so, you know. Quad core, 8-way Xeon, it's good. So here we got, we've got that same listing. I'm just trying to get synchronized here. So now it's too small. Is it too small for you guys, or can you see it? Okay, so originally on this chip, I had sat on the bus and read it. And then I just decided it was taking too much time, so I tried the instruction latch approach. That worked, but I was missing... For some reason, this particular chip gave me some trouble with this. It doesn't always work like you hope it would. And so I went back to the invasive single-needle glitches. And the problem with that is the time, as I said. The nice thing about this was I realized that Infineon on PowerUp all of a sudden has this, like... take some bytes from the outside world and stuff them into memory indirectly and, you know, decrement register and loop. Well, it's beautiful because the stack is at 7 or 8 still, wherever it powers up to, and the loop should be like 10 bytes, and we whack the R3 and we can overwrite the whole stack, load our program in and go wherever we want. But to load the program in, we needed to first do a lot of running logs, maybe send a 5-byte ISO header into it, see what it wants. Can we overwrite the stack through the ISO header? We probably can. In most cases, they loop that too. Or they loop some of the bytes coming out of the HDR to, if you want to read out the entire memory space, or E-square, let's say. So we see here, here's the initial power-up code. We see there's that move of into D8, that 10, this is the clock count right here. This is the line of code it was on. These are the whatever number of of instruction and operands are present. A clear A takes 3 clock cycles. It's an E3. Where is it? There it is right there. So boom, program counter low comes out, E4 instruction, it clears the accumulator, what's next? And it just continues and continues and continues. And so basically, there's some strange behavior that nobody would know unless you're at this level. And this is something that we were examining earlier when we wrote the script that you'll see get executed. And things like R1 touches of increments, it starts it and then it finishes it during the next instruction's dispatch. It's just the weirdest behavior. But I mean, they can do it as long as they get both things done sequentially. So if we go back to this line of code, we see that there's this like thing in PowerUp right here. It says jump. And by the way, guys, this code is pretty much static across any 44 series. If I show you it from the 66, it's going to be static in the P or the S with some variety to it sometimes. But pretty much all the S's would be the same, and all the P's would be the same, all the 44 series are the same. Every Infineon 4466 is going to do this thing that we're going to abuse. So if the IO line is high, execute the ROM code that you wrote in, or the designers wrote. But if it's low, they go into this what I call CMS hello, which is like the hello of the Infineon part, give you a lot number of things like this. It's very cool though. They start the data pointer at 8,000, and then they read out 10 bytes or it could be 11 bytes. It depends on which series. This is for practical, for our hands-on. It's not really a loop that's easily abused because the high side of the data pointer is not getting incremented. So we're stuck in the page of 256 of where they set it. And if you look up above, they had set it to 80. So because they set this to 80, we're only going to be able to glitch and get out 8,000 to 8,000 FF in the memory map, but it's E-square, and there's a lot of secrets a lot of times in these people's codes up in the front, and then they put all of the of their code later in time. I was just going to get into that. So with a little more effort, I can start playing around and I can start, exactly, make it 81, make it 82, make it 83, but it's a pain. It really is. So I would find a better loop if I really wanted to do this. And there is a better loop because the stack pointer abuse is in here too. But for today, quick demo. I did it on the machine in my room this afternoon. We're going to basically bring it into this area, and notice it says move in a 10 into R2. So that means it basically R2 is going to become their counter, and it's going to think it's going to send out 16 bytes of the EEPROM to us. Well, it's going to send out 256 when we're done. So there's a little delay here. They pull a value from E-square. So this is a special instruction from these guys, and we'll abuse it. But notice only R1 gets incremented. So since R1 is the only thing getting incremented, it's not going to get us too far. But maybe there is something we do need, like a secret backdoor key, or maybe the only key that you need is in the clear right there at that point of memory, or it's encrypted but you know how to decrypt it. Things like this. So hypothetically, this will be fun. When it's done, it does some things. We don't care about this. It's going to end up freezing because the chip is not in Infineon's test mode any longer. If we did want to read it out, we wouldn't have come here. We would have followed this jump to 45 right here. We'd let all this stuff, we would glitch this, or we would glitch this to check that they do. Because Infineon claims that you can never get back into test mode. They're liars. But they're nice ones. Because, I mean, you really normally can't get back in, but I can get back in, So we can change the address of this fetch, or we can change the data fetch from the address. There's a bunch of ways to skin the cat, but I prefer to keep the line, keep one needle only down and never move it. So it's much easier. If you don't have a laser cutter, you don't want to be moving, trying to open up two different tracks. And so here you can open the track with like a sewing needle and a 45 degree angle, kind of stab the silicon, and you can pop the glass off the top. This will work for you, but down to about 350 nanometers if the wires are spaced apart. If they're too close together, you'll probably short two wires together, two tracks. And it may still run though, so you may still be okay. Okay, so we're going to glitch this. If we wanted to overwrite that stack we were talking about before, we'd continue. We would be changing the behavior, so it, instead of going towards normal power up, it goes towards getting back into their test mode. It's behavior they're trying desperately to keep us out of. So this is just one check of several checks that you'd have to get through. We'd have to change this one, then we have to change this A call. If this A call comes out the way it's written, it'll freeze on this next instruction. So, yes.
What's the 4-byte password?
I don't remember. The 4-byte password is something they set in memory. It needs to be like, it's like 4-byte Infineon password that says, yeah, you're in test mode still, type thing. And when you're done, it's an OTP value. I think it's 99. It's like, actually the A9 is one of the bytes, if I remember correctly. And the 33 shouldn't be 33 yet. So those two are two of them. But when they're done, the 8,000 byte becomes the 33. They took away some of the other bits. And the A9, I believe they destroy that to something else. And then they write the lock code in on all the good stuff. It's a 4-byte password, but we destroy that A call. And that's, see, so what am I saying here? I'm saying 51A4. So, oh, do you see what I did? So this used to be 51B5. I'm sorry. No. This is here. I destroyed this A call with it. So instead of being A5, I make it A4 by grounding out the bit zero of that fetch. So we've done some glitches to get past like this 4-byte password and things like this. And now we'll do a glitch here to make sure that this jump if not carry goes in a good way and not a bad way, or it's going to freeze us right there. But again, if it freezes us right there, we could do something to change that too. It's just probably not going to sit on D0 anymore. They've got some weird thing here. I thought it was maybe an erase, bulk erase, because you're trying to get back into their test mode of the. So sometimes they try to bulk erase memories, but it's not. I have no idea what it does. They do some silly things we don't care about, and then they call this routine at C5, and this I've never seen in any of the other 44s that I worked on that were used by my old employer. But on the commercial ones in GSM, the Leapfrog card, the Silent card, every commercial over the shelf 44 otherwise has this in it, and I don't know why. So when I'm done building the script over at the stack, it'll work on pretty much all of these popular 44 public chips. So C5 says receive a byte, store it in wherever R1's pointing, increment the pointer, decrement R3, if it's not zero, continue fetching bytes. One squash of that R3 and we can overwrite the stack and we're done. If you've got to prepare everything and make sure it's the right stacking of the whatever you're going to do, and it will work fine. So today, how many people want to put a needle actually down? Do you want to see me walk the bus and build? Should I walk the bus? I want your input here. Should I walk the bus and build this script like you see here, similar to that, in front of you, so you can see exactly how it's being built? And you can see how, if I had things wrong and the data bus wasn't right, they're always laying their data buses in like a sequential ordering of 0 to 7, 7 to 0. Even today, the latest Infineon 66s claims all this address bus scrambling. That's great, but I'm not going to sit out there on the ROM. I'm going to go right to the heart, the core, and it's right in series again, in sequential ordering again. Some people never learn. Thompson, same thing. Anybody use ST Thompson products? Yes or no? I didn't see any hands. ST. Yeah, so the whole Smart Card 19 series line is on microcode. Infineon 66 runs on microcode. These are no-nos for today because these point me right to the instruction latches of these architectures. 220 nanometer, 180 nanometer, they can't be any smaller than 150 or they'd be copper. And they're not copper processes or they turn gangrene a day later. So these chips are getting smaller, but they're still running on old school techniques. They've got the room to lay pure logic implementation like an AVR has. MLAVR has no microcode or PLA in it whatsoever. Freescale likes to do it, Thompson, ST, a lot of them. They're a hacker's dream, to go backwards through the maze, kind of. So, I need about 2 minutes to set up. I think it'd be great if you guys want like come up and hang out. I think if you maybe that's easier. I'll try to talk into the mic, and we'll build the log. In fact, if you guys want, one of you guys can hit the key for me to like take the samples. And then when we're done, you guys can try to put the needle down, which is very hard. So basically, this is a used Carl Seuss PH150 micropositioner. These things are about $6,000 new. You can get them for under $1,000 used on the surplus market. When you get them used, they don't come with the little arms, the nice little arms that I'll show you a picture on the screen. So basically, it's hard to see, so I'll show you here. That's a probe needle right there. You can see the little needle. It's going into an MLAVR. This is used in some type of pirate device or something back when I was with my old employer. Get put out of anything, one needle can get it out. So with one needle, I can turn off a lock bit on a lock microcontroller. And it's funny because I build these libraries of chips that I've whacked. Thompson 19, 5 needles, the code's out. I've got it down to 4 needles now. So you can see I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 micropositioners laid around the table, laid around this die. This little wire that you see going over here, it's going to a different board. I build these little boards out of CD carriers and then Radio Shack parts. And then you can see there's a smart card slot that I put a hole in. I don't know if everybody can see it, but I wish I tried to get a camera hooked up here, but I couldn't do it. So there's a little hole there. The smart card goes in. And if the smart card's been opened, one of these is opened. You'll see it through the hole, and the needle can touch it. We're going to work with one that I've rebonded down. So I've actually thrown it completely into acid. Actually, here's a smart card. So it's a whole nother. It'd be a whole day to show you guys like opening these chips and stuff. The best thing would be to see the wired video. So I'll just pass it around. They probably never come back. That's fine. I actually got a bunch of swag to give away later. So this is what an open smart card looks like. It's still alive. All the bond wires are attached to it. I'll typically use like another smart card and kind of take an X-Acto knife and just chop out the module and kind of clean up the area where it lived, and I'll tape it back into place with some scotch tape to make sure I don't obviously isolate, you know, any of the conductor the contacts that I need, like ground, VCC, and so forth. So these are actually really handy to be a carrier as well. And there's only a few different module types of where they sit in their positioning to make the contact when it slid in. But a smart card, again, it's just a microcontroller that's been upgraded as, you know, meshing is added to it, things like this today. But it basically, the fundamental of it was some type of off-the-shelf chip before. The needles, you can't really see them, but I'll pass this one around too. Just that if you touch the end, you'll damage the tip. And the tip is shaved to a very, don't quote me on this. I think it's under 0.10 microns. They shave it with a chemical mechanical process. And so there's a little cat whisker at the end of this. Some people choose to buy PicoProbe, like Model 12C. Has anybody ever heard of that? It's an active buffered, like a needle holder tip to hold the needle on. And you have to buy their $30 needles, and it's very expensive. These needles are $5 each, and then I believe in making my own buffers with the lowest capacitance possible. And I succeed up to about 40 megahertz, which no smart card has ever gotten to today. And if it did, I can slow it down by finding the ring oscillator and just jamming a new signal into it. You know? So if I Thompson 19, good example, they left a big fat test pad right on the ring oscillator. So if I inject my little FPGA board here can do 24 megahertz down to divide it down to 1.5 if you wanted to. Typically I run 3 megahertz, so I just on the 19 series I used to inject 3 megahertz signal into the oscillator. It would slow it down to about 150 kilohertz, and the sensors and everything are all like based off of this. So all this low frequency, high frequency detection, it just went out the window. So I'm literally single stepping this processor with the mesh. It's got a mesh over it and such, and it was not in the wired video, but I'd be glad to show you pictures of the breaches in the mesh if you want to see them. So this is a needle. I'll pass it around. Just don't touch the chip, but maybe look at it in that light and change the angle, and you'll see there's a little whisker at the end of it, just like in the picture. What do you guys work with typically? Like, what kind of chips? You use the Atom Olivera? Which one?
Just the stuff like the tiny stuff.
Okay.
Just the off the shelf.
Most of my pictures are on another drive. I have like 60 gig in pictures that, you know, some of these pictures are 300, 400 megabytes and things like this. And so I have like all these pictures and not enough space to store them on my laptop drive. So I had to like delete some of them, and I wanted to, I had like MSP430 for Travis Goodspeed's talk and things like this. But so here's a Mega 647. Anybody use it? No? So this is just an overall of the die. It's got a little dirt on it, but you're not supposed to really be seeing this. It's for me, but it gives me an overall of where things live. So this is a 3-metal layer, 350 nanometer process. I actually don't know where the RAM is. It's buried in here somewhere. You'd have to strip off top metal to see more underneath because the wires are hiding things. But here's the flash, and then here's the E square, and then the fuses. Should be over here on this particular one. I think actually here. So what I did after I found them is I make a little nice little photo like this. And basically, there's the fuses. They were on the edge. It's just there's so many varieties of where they live on AVRs. It's tough. And so you put down two needles on these two wires. They're highlighted in red. You hold them low, and you read the chip back out like it was never locked. And then you wonder why your code got stolen, or you know, or whatever happened to it. You know, people hijack everybody's IP all the time, and unfortunately, it's hard to protect against it.
What's the FPGA board for?
So this FPGA board used to be a custom microcontroller design board that I did when I was in NDS is actually the first BGA board I ever made. And it has a lot of flaws on it, believe it or not. It's like nine layers, something like this. But it was our first BGA-based design. And so we didn't bring enough test pads out, and there's a bunch of patches. And then you know, USB serial came out, and so I tied it into a FTDI 232. Hi, Steve. And there was a lot of cuts drilling to this to fix shorts. So we got our act together and we did a new version of this board. And the new version of the board, I just can't get the instruction set agreed on. And I call it the WASP. And I don't remember what it stood for because I did it in 2005. But it has 16 megabytes by 8 of static RAM. And then it has 8. Actually, here, I think I have an image of the. No, maybe I don't have the set. Anyway, it I actually have I have it in my room. But so it has 8 individual like 8 needles could come into it or drive things like this. It can voltage adjust from 1.65 volts up to 5.5 digitally through a digital potentiometer designed with individual regulators. There's actually 9 of them, but 8 of them are meant for needles. So there's like little there's 8 5-pin header rows because I basically need. I need five wires on my little homemade drivers that I make. I need VCC ground. I need the sense. I always want to sense what I'm seeing on the needle. Overdrive or high Z. Which do I want? Do I want to listen or do I want to actually make a change? And then if I do make a change, what's the value going to be? That's yellow. So yellow is what's the value. Green is hit it or don't hit it type thing. And orange is always returning the value. So this is basically the original design and that I tried a long time ago. And this works up to about 12 megahertz. But after that, I have a better one than this. That's a Philips 126 with only 2 drivers, and it's good down to 1.65 volts. And it's what I'm normally using, but I didn't want to take this apart. And I figured leave good. So, anybody else have questions? I didn't finish the FPGA though, actually. Well, the FPGA, okay, I'll get the code out, let's say. It's just going to be a bit stream, and I can clone you like this, but you're trying like Vertex 4, Vertex 5 type thing?
Something. Smaller.
Like
the lighter weight one.
Like, how about an Altair Max 7000 series? Yeah, so let's say you were running a Cool Runner, or you're running a Xilinx. I've hit them. I've hit a lot of this stuff. When I say hit, I mean I've analyzed it and I've studied it and just kind of got an idea. But the attacker, if he does get your code out, it's pretty expensive probably. And when he's done, he won't know what you did. He'll just know how to copy it, you know, and write the same bitstream in. So you take like an Altera 7064. Maybe my next class should just be like showing you guys pictures the whole time, you know. But so Altera 1996 die. These guys really had their act together. Does anybody work for Altera? No. Well, if anybody knows anybody in Altera, this is really nice because this is 1996. They had some good techniques, and it got better and better. And of course, today they're 65 nanometer FPGAs. So it took me like 3 weeks to find what you're seeing in 5 minutes. They have test pads laying around the die. So these are test pads, like this guy and this guy, this guy, this guy. The designers thought they might need to, to come back later and look at it. And so they lay these big, fat, huge pads that I can come down and touch with a needle very easily. Touching this pad compared to touching this wire, for the average Joe, it's pretty hard. Unfortunately, with some practice, you can get it really quick. But these pads tell an attacker not only I should rephrase that. These pads make things easy for the attacker, but they also make him say, hey, why did you leave that pad there? There's a reason you left the pad there if you were the designer, so I'm going to find out why. So the first thing he may do is open up every one of these pads, put down a needle and say, locked, what's it look like? So, unlocked, what's it look like? Or just read it back and drive it, or don't, drive a 0, drive a 1, drive the inverse of the state, things like this. None of these pads did any good. The fuse was actually, it was buried under this, here we go again, it's buried under this pseudo mesh. So this is not really active, so to say, but it works, because what Altera did was they routed every conductor from the left side of this picture, way like hundreds of micrometers to the left. They routed them completely across the die, and they're all pretty much equal length, covering every one of the logic cells that stores the configuration. So now to get the fuse is in there somewhere. Where is it? It's a single cell of non-volatile EEPROM, so it can be erased or set. And they claim that it will only get cleared once you do a bulk erase of the chip. It's not always the case, so be careful. Sometimes you can start the erase, kill the power, and it erases the lock bit first and then does the bulk erase instead of the other way. So you can see, like, this was before I learned how to use Photoshop. So my lines aren't straight. Got little dots on it because it's just too hard to keep it straight. And, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. So you pull out the book and dig, and you figure out, you know, what shift does and things like this. They made one mistake on this design. UV set the fuse. So ultraviolet light, after 45 minutes to an hour, set an unlocked part to a locked state. So guess what I did? I opened about 10 of these things and put nail polish masks down all over. Here we go again with the nail polish from the video. Start laying nail polish blocks UV and HF. HF, though, for the record, it will only block it for about 30 to 45 seconds. Then it starts to kind of like, you know, make it like moist enough to kind of saturate through and get down. But you're going to rinse in 15. Okay, so you follow it down to here. It comes from metal 2. It goes down to metal 1, and then it goes across. And you can barely see what's underneath here. This is not a planarized die, which means they didn't polish it smooth at all on the underlayer, so you can see the ripples of where wires are underneath. Like, you can kind of see tracks in these pictures going up and down versus across as well. So the fuse is buried under here, and a lot of work and effort showed me that this line right here was the magic line to make it unlock itself. You guys using AVRs and 89 series Atmels, they're very secure against UV light attacks because they actually set their fuse under UV instead of clearing the fuse. We're like a Cypress USB controller. Does anybody use Cypress? The 63, I don't know what they are, but they're like the most popular USB controllers for dongles, security dongles. Aladdin eToken Pro 60 uses a combination of a smart card chip and one of those controllers. Not sure what you'd find in something like this, but some of these dongles just have that with an E-square. It's very insecure. UV light, nail polish, UV light, boom. You got the code out in 5 minutes. Okay, so let's go do some needles. I was going to get into this, but we don't. There's no way in heck we'll ever get into this. I talked about it at Black Hat, if you guys were there, but this is Thompson 16 CF54, and this had a mesh over the top of it. It was a very old school mesh, but again, the principles that they apply today like they did yesterday. So here's the remainder of the mesh after I hit it with HF with a mask, and then here's the data bus right in the middle of the chip. And you can see, I mean, it's just beautiful. It's a one metal layer with poly. And this is just like a test hit with a laser. And then there's your 8 tracks. And it's either 0 to 7 or 7 to 0. I don't remember which way it went. So here's a good question. Here's some microcode. You've got these ROM tables. Let me open it. I've got a different picture here to show you, actually.
What do you do if the data bus isn't exposed on the bottom layer?
It's always exposed somewhere. Where is it exposed, or is it routed correctly, or together is the question, but it's always going to be exposed in coming out of the memory, for example. I'll go to a newer chip. This is kind of an older device, and if we go to something newer, see what we have here. This is what you'll deal with a lot today. This is an active mesh on a 66P. So it's 4 conductors. You can see them. Basically, what this is like where it comes in and out of the bottom of the chip to check security. It's basically like circuit. It's like 4 circuits that come in and out of an in and an out. The problem with Infineon's design is the in and the out are about not even 50 micrometers away from each other. So to get through this beautiful 220 nanometer substrate to get underneath this, I just need a focus ion beam workstation, and to do 4, 8 cuts, you know, basically open the in and the out of each of the 4 circuits, and then deposit metal across the 2 to short them together. There's no type, no chip to date that I've seen has ever had any type of analog meshing. Where with an analog mesh, I'd have to open it, measure, cut it, measure what I'm about to patch around, and then lay a certain resistance in metal deposit. I prefer to deposit with tungsten. But some prefer platinum. So it's pretty easy to do that. I use a focus ion beam workstation. So it's like 5-nanometer precision ion beam that fires down into onto your chip. I might have some pictures of what I've been done with it on here. And it can basically mill, or it can deposit. You can deposit silicon dioxide, or, you know, like an insulator, or you can deposit metal. And the metal choice would be tungsten or platinum. And basically any fib can do either, but they'll tell you it can't, but they can, and it's just a temperature change, and tell the system, you know, platinum or tungsten's inside. But then you want to eat holes too. But the fib won't eat through this mesh as nice as wet chemicals will, because you'll get uneven etching. You'll get where the fib will leave the metal tracks, but all the oxide's been removed. And it's a big problem, and that's the reason that there's actually probably a space between the lines. But wet chemicals is a whole different ballgame. So you can mix wet chemicals from the Wired video with those techniques with the fibbing techniques. So maybe I don't know where the data bus was. I think you asked that. It's not always in order, but here we are in the core of a 66P. This thing's still produced today. I mean, it's the flagship 8-bit 8051 processor they're producing. Does anybody here work for Infineon, or did I ask that?
Yeah.
I asked, okay. Does anybody work for any of these major chip companies?
Fabian.
What's that? I'll get to you in 1 second. Okay. So Xilinx is the same way. Xilinx is actually reverse, kind of, almost like a reverse Polish, you know, notation calculator. Altera set their lock bits with UV. You guys clear them. It's bad, bad, bad. No. So in your case, all I need to do is mask where the bit stream's been stored in, like, say an XC. 95 dot dot dot, you know, CPLD or a cool runner I haven't spent much time on, but I have some images of them. I need a reason. And when I was in NDS, I didn't care. I had all the time in the world to do this kind of stuff, but now I kind of have to take jobs at a company's come to me and said, hey, we want to know how strong is this chip really, but the vendor is always going to tell you how strong it is, so to speak, and the data sheet's going to tell you like obscured busing and all this, like the 66 right here. But this is not obscured. This is physically in order. This is ordered from 0 to 7. Now, if you can get to this area, good luck, because you do need a fib. So you need a fib to do the bridge or the mesh, and it needs to remain. You need to then use wet chemicals to open up, and then there's another ground plane over this area. So you've got to kind of fib twice. But once you're through and you've prepped all this, you're good to go. It's only running at about 10 megahertz, and if you drop VDD down to under like 3.3 volts versus 5 volts, the chips all tend to slow down a little bit because propagation delays grow as the voltage level drops. So let's see, we'll go to Xilinx, and I better get rolling here. You guys are going to miss the parties. Okay. No? Okay. Well, I don't know where the parties are. My wife and I are wondering, so if you guys know, that'd be great. So, where? How do I get in? Is it? Okay. So we'll talk to you later. Okay, cool. I'll bring the Pro Station. No. So, I don't know. Anybody work for HP? Thanks. Yeah. No, I actually don't have Xilinx with me. I have it with me, but it's in my room. It's on that other drive. I ran out of space, as I was saying. So basically, let's go back to the task at hand here, and let's get rocking. Yeah, exactly. See, the guy says, let's probe something. We shall. Okay. So we're going to focus our whole area in here. I'm going to keep it up on the screen. So actually, I can't keep it up on the screen. I'm going to do my best to keep it on the screen. So here's what we're looking at. This is all we care about on this chip. We care about this area. I'm going to rotate it. This is how it's going to look for us under the microscope. So basically, this is data bus bit 0. This is data bus bit 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. What we'll do first, we'll do a running code. We'll pull the running code of each, you know, so we'll sample each of these lines for, say, 32,000 clock samples, see what was on the bus and stuff. You're going to get basically the same log file that I had showed you earlier. Then we can look at that. Actually, it'll be a different log file because we're going to go into that non-ISO reset mode instead of normal power-up. So after we do that, I'll show you the location that we're going to squash. I'll show you how Brooke Hill and I timed it earlier up in my room. and we'll do the same. We'll basically repeat those steps over again, and then you can kind of be in my world of how I would do it. But again, this is just kind of proof of concept to you, because it's not that useful, because it's only 256 bytes, 100 hex. All right. So the FPGA board that was asked about before, it's basically, today, I wrote little, like a RISC processor into it, like that, it's only 8-bit fetches, it's because the way I like to write little scripts, it's a pain to kind of stuff 36 or 32 bits across. The new one that I came out with that I can't agree on the instructions on is very long instruction word, 36-bit fetch, using a synchronous datagram. But again, the problem is I don't like the way, like here I say like, you know, I can say like, you know, on one line buff I plus, you know, I'm filling a buffer and then I just ship it down to the board and then the board begins executing at 24 megahertz each line, so to speak, and doing certain things. I can tell it what clock cycle, I can tell it, you know, divide the clock by whatever our clock is here, 24 megahertz, divide it by 8, that's typically what I do, run the smart card nice and slow, they all accept 3 megahertz. If it's running on its own internal clock, that really doesn't do anything for me except to talk to it. That's the only thing. I'm going to have to pluck their clock out. I can tell the board, though, give them a clock, but take their clock from a needle and you run on that clock instead. And so externally clocks, basically. I can also tell it which edge to clock the data in on, positive or negative edge of that clock signal coming in. I had thought to try to run it through a PLL, but then I realized some of these chips, like the Infineon 66, they run an asymmetric clock cycle. So it's like 100 nanoseconds and 200 nanoseconds, hypothetically. It's not 100 and 100 in a nice square wave. So a PLL goes crazy and doesn't come out with the right multiplied frequency. So we can also tell it, if it is running on our clock, such as the chip we'll work on, we can tell it, I want to be on, for example, I can oversample if I want to, but there's no reason to. So we're just going to take one sample per clock cycle. There's no reason to take two per clock cycle because I only have, I think, on the inside the Xilinx, 256,000 by 2 bits wide of memory space. It's an 812EM extended memory. So we can tell it, take a sample and where in that window we want it to be in an eighth. So we can tell it, when the clock fires, wait 2/8 and then sample, or wait 1/8 and then sample, or wait 8/8, but I don't know why you'd wait that long. You know, that's not, honestly not going to work. But so it's pretty wild what you can do with the board. And I'm always adding things to it. So now what I've done is I've frozen the design. It's frozen. It was done in Leonardo Spectrum and Verilog. And it's just, I write in Precision Synthesis and Verilog now instead. So I don't even want to mess with the design to convert it or anything. I just want to leave it frozen and just get the new one working. But it's a lot. It's a lot of time. So does anybody read my blog, the PhyLogic blog?
Yeah.
Carsten Knoll's going to start writing for it for me to help me out. I have no time to write, guys. I have a 4004 that I need to post, the Intel 4004 from MIT. MIT told me that it's the highest resolution pictures they've ever seen of the 4004. It's 1971 November, I think it came out. And that's the thing, the net masks back then, or the mask set, the quality that the image looks like is ancient. You know, so the optical resolution at 200 mag that I did on it is just phenomenal. It's really lights up. And there's polylayer and there's the metal layer. I think it's an NMOS or might be PMOS. I forget. It's fun, though, to trace off the circuitry. So that'll get posted soon. And I'm always answering emails. It's just the blog is kind of, it's the last thing I can do, you know. That means I'm busy. So this script is like basically, you know, turn off the overdriver. If we are going to run the overdrive, I have two overdrive circuits here versus 8 on the new one. So let's just drop talking about the new one, then we'll focus on this one. So we have two overdrivers that we can do. We only have one needle right now, though. I have a second, but it doesn't want to stay down. So we're going to work with one. We have limited space on this little thing, and it's really flimsy, and it's going to be a challenge to put the needle down because everything's moving, and this is the base is fixed, and normally the base, you can move the base. Normally I'll kind of nudge a needle into position. I'll get it right around it, and I'll kind of nudge a little bit on the base with the micro positioner, and kind of just, and it goes in. And here we can't, so it's going to be a challenge. But I've done it, and you guys are going to do it. So we'll be glitching low when we do finally glitch. This is some stuff. I have a FIFO in here that can receive data and store and just hold it in a FIFO. Or I can block read the bytes in to stay in a precise sync timing if I need to. The board can if you were randomizing your software and I don't feel like figuring out where the call was or how it works or I can't destroy the call, what I can do is I can take a sample and then I can take two needles and I can bring them both in and I can say I want you to sample up to 64 bits. Don't like a logic analyzer basically. Don't start sampling until the 64th transition of the pattern I just gave you comes in. And so now your randomizer just went down the tubes because you're eventually I'm going to pick a location that is out after it. And so, you know, my board's going to wait until it sees a pattern. And its depth is up to 64 bits. So basically, they're just little commands that we write, little nano commands. You know, do this, do that. Make the IO pull up, turn on the receiver FIFO. Do a delay, fire and then this is the kicker right here. It's going to be to fire the overdrive line to basically drive that zero. So earlier, before we let the chip come out of reset, we prepared it to say drive a low. So this instruction put a low on our little yellow line that I talked about earlier. So we're ready to drive, and when we do drive, it'll be a low signal, a low pulse. Sometimes you do multiple glitches, though. So, I mean, I didn't have to do that. It's just convenient to kind of lay it in up in the front. So basically, we're going to fire the overdrive. We're going to leave the overdrive on momentarily for 10 clock cycles. This is a 24-bit delay that I wrote into the logic. So it sees this little command, and then it takes three values, three operand values. It's another reason why 36 bits would make it a better execution than fetching 4 bytes or 3 bytes. So we hold the overdrive on after a specific count, cycle count, clock cycle count. We hold it on and we do this small 24, you know, so that's 10 times 24 megahertz, whatever the reciprocal is of it, in timing. The delay, we're going to momentarily overdrive that signal down to ground, which is going to squash the decrement jump if not zero of R3. But what it's going to squash is the one coming out on the bus to become a zero. And so basically what this instruction says in logic is decrement the value. If it's not zero, stay in the loop, branch relative. So we don't want to kill anything else. We just want to kill that one coming out. And we remember the one coming out forced as a zero means it goes into the ALU as a zero now. It then underflows and becomes an FF because there's only 8 bits. If we're too long, it would become like FE. It would come out as an FE because we'd still be driving low. So we're only going to drive for 10 times the reciprocal of 24 megahertz, whatever that is for nanoseconds. It's going to be like 60, maybe 60 nanoseconds. What's 50 is 20? You guys can figure it out. I use a calculator too much. So we turn it off, and then we just kind of wait some time because now we need to wait time to let the UART fetch the remainder of these bytes that are going to come in. So one glitch will destroy this loop, and the loop will remain in the loop for another 255 clock repetitions. And then this just says turn off the little snippers that are sampling on whatever I previously told it to sample. So there's a whole bunch of parallel blocks of logic in here that are doing different tasks. And that's about it. But that's only one part of this program. But I have to take the mag off because I can't see. So I have to undo what Brooke and I did in the room earlier, or it's going to just glitch the card right away when we want to actually just sample the card at first. So I'm going to comment it out for us. I'm going to put the mic down though, guys. So basically, I'm going to comment more than this out. A bunch of this is basically, we just basically want to power up the chip and let it run and just listen. Okay, one more second. This should be good. So basically, when this flow of code hits this snip off statement, it'll turn off the sniffer to, because if it sniffs too much, it's going to wrap around and it's going to overwrite samples I originally took in the beginning. So we'll delay some clock period of time. It's something, some value I pick. I think it's like 1A hex cycle. 1A 1,000 hex cycles will delay. And that's just enough to get the entire reset out of the chip. Okay. I do. Yeah, but the pump's starting to seize up on me today. So, can everybody hear me off the mic?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the pump started to seize up on me today, so I'm going to actually, don't laugh at this, but this is why we're working on such a big chip too, because you guys can put the needles down, and the pump's going out. It's the one thing that I should have brought two of that I didn't. It's the only thing I didn't bring two of. And since the pump's going out, I'm going to electrical tape the positioner in place after it's vacuumed down. I mean, this is just crazy. You know, you shouldn't be able to do this, but you can, you know. And so because we can, you guys can play too. So that's the whole point here. So I actually have to change the needle too. Is that needle good? Did you guys touch it? No, I mean I can use it still if it didn't get bent. If it's either bent or it's not. Yeah. Okay, awesome. Hey, I sometimes I burn through these things so fast and I'm like $5. No. Well, that's the thing. If it's the PicoPro, I have PicoPro 12Cs, and I have a ton of needles for them and stuff, and they're good, but you have to adjust capacitance, you're loading on them and stuff, and it's unique per device typically, and the needles are too expensive. I mean, they really are. So I think, I don't know what they are now, but these needles used to be like $350, and then when I called and ordered like 100 needles a year ago, she was like, it's been like 4 years since they've been, you know, $350, and I was like, well, I need to be making needles and not be making this, you know, cracking chips. You know. Okay, so we're going to work on this chip. This is the Xilinx chip, wherever they went. So this chip is in here, and if we take a razor blade, which we could, but it's buried under there, and we cut out this area, you could actually see it underneath the you know, the card without popping the module out, or you just pop the module out, whatever. So basically I threw it into fuming nitric, let it be completely etched. I'm afraid to pass it around because it's got five little bond wires that if they get broken off, we won't be able to play, but you'll see it when you look at it through the microscope and projective. So I'm gonna try to kind of set this up, and if anybody has questions, please ask. This whole station is basically a Velcro setup. This is something Bunny Wang and I built for Torcon 9 last year. If you guys ever go to Torcon, we'll probably do something like this again. It's a lot of fun. You know, everybody can get some time to play and have the whole day to do it. That's it. We actually did a two-part lecture kind of in hands-on on the Infineon SLE 4442, which is Kinko's. Anybody know the Kinko's?
Yeah,
it's that processor. That's actually not why we did it, though. We did it just because it was a fun old chip that I didn't care about, and I thought it'd be a good experience, and it was fun. It was actually a lot of fun. So this year we'll do something better, maybe more logic, you know, and stuff. So Bunny went over principles for like first principles, and then we got into second principles, which is more the way I work. I rarely study logic unless I have to, but if I have to, that's not a problem. It just takes me time. I don't live in, you know, a world of poly and the metal and what dopings are they, but it's not that hard to figure out where the P FETs are and where the N FETs are. And when you do figure it out, that whole row is going to be P's, and that whole row is going to be N's.
Do you have anything to work with SLEs for form rate?
Yeah, sure. You want to see it? I have it on here. I've torn everything apart, and it's, you know, I mean, just to see what is it, how it, you know, is it really that secure? And
the chance to play with the any of the Cavium network chips?
Never seen them, no. But it's more larger scale than what I would mess with. The SLE 4448.
4448.
Oh no! What is it? What is it exactly?
It's a coder.
It's 4442 base or something? Could the 44?
No, it's different. It's
because this is a 4428.
Telephone cards.
Oh, I've seen it. I've seen it. Yeah, and I've also seen the ST.
It's also used a lot on laundromat cards.
So it's basically the same family member as this one. I thought you said the 28, which is what this is. So this is a 28. And the 28, I couldn't get the whole thing to stitch. Stitching these chips when it's repetitive memory areas and things like this, it's hard because there are always many, many pictures wide. This is another old chip, though, from them and stuff. But this is a... see, that's not the part number. What I'm highlighting with the mouse, M1265, blah, 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 that's really... a 4428, that's what it is. So you have to build a library up. 4442 is maybe close to what you're talking about.
4442 is the one with FedEx keyboard.
Yes, and then now they have a 55 series. I've seen that one. Have you seen this? No? I don't know. I'll have to look this up. I'll take a look at it. But it's going to be something like this. If it's a 44 series, it's this era of a technology. I believe this was... NMOS, but it may have been PMOS. And again, look at all these test pads. Here, it's secure. This is some secure memory. If they can't be between the machine and the card when the password's sent, they won't get the password because you have, I think, three tries. But what if I sit on the data bus? Guess what I see? I see the password come right out. You brought up a good point, too. I can show you the F4442 run, I think. No, I can't. I thought I could.
But you have to sneak the traffic between the card and the machine that reads the card, right?
Yes.
Or can you simulate that in the lab?
I can simulate it in my lab because I know where the logic is, the MUX that throws the MUX up. Did you supply the PSC or not? The PSC is the pin code or something. They call it PSC in the 4442, the 5542. But really not much changed. Here, the fifth. What's that? I know, I'm trying. No more questions. Okay. Like 5542. Like here's the busing too. Like 0, 2, 4, 6, and then there it is again. I'm like leaving little comments about the bus, and you can see there the plugs. This is a very old chip, but these chips are great to learn on. And this duck actually controls if it lets you read back the password or not. If you, so I mean, it's so weird. The duck's pointing at the secrets. So like this test. If you take this test pad and you drive it low, it's either this test pad or this test pad, and you can see it. If you know the PSC and you write it in, you'll watch that line on one of those two signals. The line goes low when it's finally been given valid. So if that line is low, it lets you read out the PSC. If the line is high, it throws a MUX. And the MUX says set a zero instead.
Is it encrypted though?
Or? Well, no, it's not encrypted. You just like Strom Carlson did. You just sniff the traffic, and you know the average Joe just sniffs the traffic, and he knows the password. So now Kinko's, the company that makes Kinko's smart cards, randomizes the password and has like a few bytes that can tell it how to generate what the password is. So they run it through some type of hash or something, and the result is what the password would be. So now you got to steal the machine. You know? But like this is their latest stuff, and if you read about this, they're telling you stuff like highly secure 1.2 micron, you know, CMOS process. And I'm thinking 1.2 micron, that's 1200 nanometer process now. It's, you went up instead of down. You know, honestly, I talk about these chips and I make jokes about them. I love to work on Infineon, Thomson, Dallas, Maxim, Microchip, Atmel AVRs. I love all these chips. I mean, it's the reason I have all the libraries of them. The ones I can't stand are like Renesas, all these weird architectural ones that are large. And I don't know, I just get more thrill from these guys. Scilabs, it's a TSMC production. I forgot to, that's the one of the other brand I was thinking to mention earlier. Which Scilabs? No, which Scilabs chip? Oh, so Scilabs, I thought I had, see, this is my bad image directory. It's not up to date because I ran out of space. But Scilabs, I have a whole ton of Scilabs parts done. It's the same thing. It's basically do a bulk erase, tell it you bulk erased it, but don't don't let the bulk erase happen, and that the register lock bits get cleared because they assume it happened when it really didn't, and you read memory out. Or you can do an address bus attack. We talked about that earlier. That's another reason that I didn't think of to do an address bus attack. You know they fetch from the very last address in memory. They read that byte out, and then bits of that byte represent I'm locked or I'm unlocked, etc. It's a bad way to implement security. Because I know how to make that flash return FFs. So if you're doing a password where, it's a 32-byte password, I don't even know how many bits it is, that would be. But, they give you these large bit numbers, and they tell you this and that, 8-byte password on Freescale, JB8, JB16, JB12. That's great. So I short this one track down to ground, and I get zeros for the password. Short another track down to ground, I get FFs for the password. And so and you can do your own tests on this, because you can take a part that you bought from DigiKey, and you can open it up, and you can load it and just read from the memory and play around and just induce a fault into the memory and see what's the result. I grounded this line out momentarily, or I shorted or I forced it high. As long as it's not like a direct VCC or ground connection, you're fine. Anything else, and you'll probably blow your driver. If it's a VCC or a ground, you'll probably blow your driver out, and you can tell because you won't see any waveforms anymore. or you may see like noise, but it won't work. It won't give you any type of toggling like it should.
Everything you're saying really begs the question, which is, in your opinion, what is the best security?
To talk to somebody like myself that makes them all apart. that's honestly my business model, is to work with companies to help them make sure their products are strong. Well, I mean, security's layered. It's not going to come overnight. And so Infineon learns, that's always going to happen, obviously. But a lot of these companies making the chips are very arrogant, and they believe that they know what's best, and that's not true, because if it was, then you wouldn't see revisions of the die come out and marked or unmarked, and I wouldn't get into the next time, or things like this happen. And so they design the chip, but they know what they did, and they kind of, the blinders come on, and they're not in a black box to reverse engineer it. And it's ironic that you said, because when I do an analysis for some of these big companies, I don't tell them what to do, I give them suggestive solutions of what to do, what I would recommend maybe trying to do, but don't tell me what you did. And then my hope is that you'll then implement your own way of doing things and send it back to me and say, analyze it now. It's difficult for me, because they tend to say, we're going to take this and do it on every chip now. This will become the baseline. And, thanks, FlyLogic. You got $12,000 or $15,000 or some low amount of money, and we're going to make our whole platform secure now. So that part of my business model is kind of broken. But, but they're so stingy, they don't care otherwise. So I'm trying to find that win-win here to how best to help everybody, But anyway. Neither. Then they'll come and say sabotage or something, So that we don't want to do that, But that's partially the blog too. The blog is like a teaser, but the blog kind of shows them that I'm not Joe Blow off the street. I really do tear your chips apart. I know what they're doing, and I know how to unlock these chips and stuff like this. And I think I do believe it's helped. Today I'm working with a lot of the major companies of microcontrollers. I would love to work with Infineon or ST. These guys, I don't know. I know Infineon knows what I'm doing, because they got scared. And I heard through the grapevine that they're very worried. So, but I'm not a bad guy. So, okay, let's keep going here. So I've got the chip mounted down here. It's mounted in the socket. Everybody can see it. And if you can't see it, you'll see it shortly, because you can come up and look through the eyepieces and stuff. I'm very dehydrated, just FYI. Thank you. So, I don't know. It's going to get hot. I don't know. It's cool now. You may feel like you're in an air conditioner. Give it 5 minutes. So, basically, you can come up and look through it and so forth.
That's a dead package chip, and what do you use to get to what tool is there a machine that you use to do that?
There is a machine to do that. Thank you. I removed it. I told you guys we have all night. all right, let's see. So basically, I use a KNS wire bonder. It's a 4524. And this is basically what the machine looks like. And so you take this machine, you have this little mouse over here, and I run 1 mil. Most of the guys that do failure analysis at this type of a level, because really that's what I'm doing. I'm doing security risk analysis, so it falls into kind of the subcategory of failure analysis. they'll use like a 1 mil wire. Anything smaller than 1 mil, like the chip really used, like 0.7, is really hard for the average just Joe Blow to work with. It breaks a lot. It's very brittle, and the wire's not very strong because we need it floating in the air. We don't really have the epoxy shell to hold it in place, and so 1 mil is the better wire for like the person like us to use. Yeah. So basically, the machine has this little needle. It's got the little mouse right here, and the average person is going to leave it in like manual Z mode and not semi-auto. Semi-auto is another mode it can be in, where you know the height and how much force to put down and the time, and you're going to bond 50 of the same package. So, you know, if I was going to do 50 of these, I'd put it in semi-auto, and it kind of helps automate the process. But when I do a onesie twosie or five of them, I leave it in manual Z, and basically I manually, the more I push this little black button on the mouse right here, this little black button, the more I push it, the lower this little needle goes down that you can kind of not, you can almost see it, it's a little white thing. So that's called the capillary. And so the capillary is a needle that's hollow in the middle. And the gold wire comes, I think I have another photo that you can see it. You can see the capillary kind of there. So the wire is coming down through here. It's got solenoids and such, ultrasonic. Solenoids are keeping it the tension proper, and then it goes right through the middle of this little white thing, and it uses high voltage to like make the ball. It's a little ball on the bottom of it, so that's why it's called a ball bonder. So there's two types of bonders. There's wedge bonders and ball bonders. Wedge bonders are typically aluminum, and they don't need heat, although they can be heated. And a ball bonder always will be heated, although you don't really need that much heat. I keep it at, I think, 30 degrees Celsius. I may keep it at 50 degrees Celsius, because I use super glue to keep the chips glued down, because conductive epoxy, I have to bake it. It's a pain in the butt. Mm-hmm. Just like somebody said, why don't you use photoresist, the type that will wash away after I've hit it with UV patches for making masks against nail polish, because that works as well to block hydrofluoric and things. And I said, because I have to cook it, it has to be baked on. It's a pain. It's more easier to just take some nail polish and like a red color, drop the drop and spread it. So anyway, this thing makes a little ball, connects, and then you use the mouse to let go of the black button, and you move it over to the landing pad where you want to place it. You press it once more all the way, and then it comes down, and it automatically cuts it and makes a new ball with the high voltage, and the connection is done. The gold is nice, though. It's very convenient, because I can drop a ball. I can go A to B to C to D if I needed to. Sometimes on, like, MSP430s, does anybody use an MSP430? So you blow the JTAG fuse on a lot of these. I just come over, if it's like a 2000 series or a lot of these, a lot of the newer die revs from 2005 and on from TI, the JTAG fuse is visible from top metal. And the junction that they created an open on is actually on top metal. So point A needs to get to point B that's been severed. So point A is actually that test pin, you know, pin one, for example, on some of these 20-pin SOICs. So I take my laser cutter, and I blow a big hole on the B side, and then I come down with this wire bonder, and I just slap a big ball right over that hole that I made, and then I take it right to pin one. And so the JTAG fuse, without even putting a needle down now, has just been repaired permanently forever. So it's okay.
Let's say actually make connections internally,
right?
That's what you're saying.
No, in some cases. So like, let's say you have a big VCC plane for your internal core voltage, and I want it for some reason. And believe it or not, I have in the past, for my own, to be at the same exact logic level with my drivers. I'll take one of your thick VCC planes, do the same thing. Open a big hole. If it's not big enough, open several big holes. And then, you know, the more metal I expose, the better. Oh, no, we didn't even probe yet. Can we have one more hour? Can we have, like, 20 minutes?
I don't think so.
Is there some... Well, can we take it to the skybox? Where's is Joe Grant here? Joe Grand wanted me to, or that's even easier. Can everybody help pick something?
Sure.
Joe Grand wanted to bring this up to the Skybox, the hardware hacking thing or something. So,
Here,
that'd be great if we could just take the table. That'd be actually excellent.
the other hardware guy.
You're giving him the screen.
No, the screen. Oh, you're. Can we stay here?
I don't know if we all have to say thank you and we get big claps, then we can do that. Yeah.